I just can get to the next step, then I'll start thinking about that. If I just finish school, if I just can get a job, if I just can finish my house payment, if I just finish my car payment, if I just get my children established, if I can just rejuvenate my marriage, or if I can just find another marriage, or if I can just do this, then I'll start to understand what life is. But right now I have no time. The practical realities are pushing. It's amazing how we feel certain things are practical realities that are pushing and others that aren't. Who am I? Oh, that's not so important. But how to get money, how to please the body, that's very important. Those are the pressing realities. We feel financial pressures. We feel the pressures, just like you feel the pressure of when you're hungry and your stomach growls. Similarly, you feel the pressure of lust. Gotta have someone tonight. Remind me, gotta have someone. I can't have someone and I go to a cinema and see somebody having somebody on the screen. Somebody gotta have someone. I gotta have something to do with it. That's pressure, isn't it? And then, as you all know, I know that. But as you all know, when you want to have someone and they don't want you to have them, how frustrating it is. Used to be only the men who had that frustration, but now it's shared equally by the men and women, because everybody is a predator these days. It's everyone's fair game. So, that's pressure. And there's also pressure of prestige. I want my peers to appreciate me, even if I'm in some kind of countercultural punk group. Yeah, I want my fellow punks to appreciate me. That's the way it works. They got to appreciate me as the most outrageous, the one with the hair dye the weirdest color. Everybody, they caught up in peer pressure. Sydney. We're sure they did something wrong. Our friend, we trust our friends. They called us up and said, hey, come on down. This is the protest for the day. I said, well, what are you going to do tomorrow? Well, we'll find somewhere else to protest. And the next day, protesting. They felt that was their, that was their cause for existence. I'm just saying, French rise up. Their vital reasons. Yes. That was their reason. So, that's pressure. Surely you all know what it's like. You feel you have to do something. You have to go to a concert because everybody else is going. You have to watch the rugby game because everybody's watching. So we do feel pressure. But why is it that we don't feel the pressure to understand who we are, what it's like? Bhagavad Gita is giving us the vigor to take that stand. I will not act until I understand the basic things. Of course, then the question is, right, how will the world go on if everybody does like you guys and just gets super philosophical and just just try to figure everything out before they do anything. How will the practical world go on? Is the world really going on in any kind of sane way? If you study modern so-called civilization, industrial society, you'll see everything they do. How do you define material life? The Vedas describe material life in four activities. In Sanskrit, Ahara, Nidya, Vaya, Vaikuntha. You have to eat, you need sleep, you have to protect yourself from fears, and you have to engage in reproductive activities. So, if you analyze modern society, you'll see that in each of those four areas, there's going to be problems. Something are problems. They don't know how to eat without causing themselves harm and world starvation. They can't sleep without liquor or pills, smoke. Can't mate without causing themselves diseases or having to kill the offspring in the womb. And they can't defend themselves, they can't fight without wholesale slaughter of civilians. So, what are we fearing if we stop and take a deep look at what we're doing, try to understand? What will happen if? What's the harm if even a large segment of people do that? We don't have to worry. Not everyone's ever going to do that. Even during Vedic culture, believe me, golden years of Vedic culture, which are earlier than what current historians are dealing with. Although you may know that every year they push back the antiquity of human civilization goes back every year. But anyway, as soon as historians hear about Bhagavad Gita, they say, oh, this talk about how Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5,000 years ago. Yeah, it's serious, you know. But meanwhile, every year they push back the antiquity of human civilization. So, not everybody is going to stop and consider. But there must be a class or a sector or a segment of society which does that. In Vedic culture, such persons are called Brahmins, the intellectuals. They simply live for knowledge. They may say, well, that must be like the university professors of today. What do university professors live for? PhD. Right. Prestige and money. Income, so to speak, by interaction with the female students. That is part of it all. So, the Vedic intellectuals, the Brahmana sector of society, they were simply dedicated to knowledge and they didn't get any salary. They just lived off of whatever donations came from the public and whatever they didn't need. Whatever was beyond their needs in their simple lifestyle, they would give away. You say, why is that? First of all, they considered that detachment from material nature was their real wealth. The saying was that austerity is the wealth of the Brahmins. Austerity meaning they wouldn't try to please themselves with any external stimuli. Their joy was from within in terms of enlightenment, spiritual studies. So therefore, you couldn't bribe them. You couldn't influence their decisions with any kind of monetary rewards. First of all, they didn't take any salary. And secondly, they knew that material rewards were just insignificant. They were getting their pleasure from a higher level. Therefore, governments in Vedic times, they would be guided by these Brahmins. And that way, the government got the best advice all know what happens if governments try to take advice from ministers, professors these days. You can buy anybody off. Just like in America. I'm sure it's the same thing. In the States, as soon as somebody powerful starts making propaganda for vegetarianism, then you have what's called the it's a group of the meat industry has beef council or something. And you use that word here. So this organization, which is funded by the meat industry, is called the Beef Council. They immediately start trotting out professors. Here is Professor So-and-so from Southern Illinois University. And he feels there is living evidence that if you don't eat meat, your teeth are very weak. Everybody knows the game, you know. They've obviously known this is like a vacation, you know, in New Zealand this year. All you have to do is, you know, your professor, just make this presentation. Probably true, you know, it's as true as anything in science, but you know, it's not that you're lying, it's just, you just say like this, that there's very good indication that a vegetarian diet makes your teeth. Most people will fall for that. Oh, the professors know what they're talking about. Of course, people are becoming more and more shrewd, just like about the so-called moon landing. I know, you're shocked to hear this, but 25% of the American public thinks when the intellectuals and advisors and counselors of society can be bought off, you're never going to get neutral advice. But the Vedic Brahmanas, they didn't get any pay. And the love of their life was simply cultivating knowledge and detachment. Therefore, they could always be dependent upon them. If someone would give them more than they needed in charity, they would immediately give it away as part of their lifestyle. Take only what they need and give the rest away. So you can imagine how beneficial this is for any human society to have a class of intellectuals who will not be bought off, who will give their learned opinion and not be swayed. It means that the government has access to such impartial careful advice. We actually like our governments to have that kind of access, but it's not possible when all the professors are teaching and learning simply for prestige and money and sense kind of people. Anybody can get bought off. As long as you're dealing with advisors who can be bought off, society will not prosper. But as soon as you have, as advisors to the government, you have a class of persons who cannot be bought off, and if the government actually listens to those persons, then you'll see a great change. We all know that in terms of our individual lives, when we have to make a decision about something we're not involved in, we can be very crystal clear. And if it's something we're involved in, we can get really murky. They're different. have sunlight in your room, it's not that you have to worry about burning up. There's correlations, but they're different. Similarly, both matter and spirit emanate from the Supreme Source. They all attract the Krishna, but they have different energies. And that is the basis of chapter 2. Understand what you're dealing with. Everybody likes to talk about energy. Any kind of sense. Chemical energy. Mechanical energy. Or in the psychic sense. Psychic energy. Where does all the energy come from? People love to be absorbed in energy without worrying about the source. Whether it's chemical energy, electrical energy, or psychic energy. Astral energy. No one talks about the source. That like energy just happens to be. So in chapter 2 of the Gita, Krishna lays down his principles. He explains that what is the symptom of the soul? How do you get some kind of hint that there's a soul? Consciousness. Krishna said, that which pervades the whole body is consciousness. And that consciousness is the symptom of the soul. Just like you know, that no one's ever seen an electron naked eye, right? Or other stuff coming apart. But how do they know it's there? Yes. They can see the tracks in the cloud chamber. Yes. But they can't see the electron directly. But they see its tracks. They see its patterns of interaction with effects it causes. They say, oh, it must exist. Similarly, we cannot see the soul, but we can see the effects of the soul. How it influences the body. That's how Krishna teaches you in the second chapter of the Gita. So we should not think that it's unscientific to accept the existence of something you can't see when no one has seen the lecture. So many things. And of course, that's the reality. How many of you have been to Albuquerque, New Mexico? Anyone here been to Albuquerque, New Mexico? But everybody, I sure it exists. Because in the map books, sometimes you may hear about it on the news. I think that was where they had this famous UFO crash or something. And it was really a big cover of the US government. Anyway, so. You've never been there, and I'm sure you're not going there. But you feel pretty good that Albuquerque, New Mexico exists. You probably heard country and western songs about it. But that was a lot of time. I guess Phoenix was there. So, you accept authority. Yes, the authorities say Albuquerque exists. I haven't been there. I'm not going there. But it's on the map. You can see pictures of it on the news. It exists. So this way, you really haven't been there to accept presentations from us. So Krishna is teaching them the same way. You don't remember the spiritual world, you can't see the spirit soul, but I will present to you that it exists. If you take my information and you take the procedure I'm giving to you, you will verify for yourself that the soul exists. I mean, how can you prove to yourself that Albuquerque is? And you fly to Los Angeles, then Los Angeles, you fly out. There you see that proof. How do you prove yourself that the soul is there, that Krishna exists, and that there's a relationship between the two? You take up the practice of Bhagavad Gita, and you will transform your experience and realize what Krishna is saying in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna in Bhagavad Gita is inviting you into the laboratory. Take up the methods in my laboratory, Krishna, and you will see the results. You will verify the results. But no, we're also prejudiced and bigoted. Oh, it's just some kind of religious mythology. It's just, it's just dogma. We are the ones being dogmatic, but we refuse to take up the means of verification, Christian is. Suppose you tell me that in her car you're like this, and I say, no, 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 you're speaking to my parents. I've never been there. I don't know anybody who's been there. It doesn't exist. Don't be just talking stuff. It's just human folklore that you were arguing like this. I mean, every people has their folklore. don't the authors believe that New Zealand ends in the Bombay Hills? And all sorts of things like that. Oh, I see. And the South Islanders say if you cut the cable between South Island, North Island, North Island, points away. Anyway, so, I could say like that. Invercargill, it's just, I go back to university in the States, just like visit New Zealand, like any peoples of the world, they have their folklore. They all have this notion of Invercargill, like this. Of course, we know it's just their fanciful creation. But we shouldn't criticize it too heavily. Every people needs some kind of fanciful creation to keep them going. Of course, you all be very insulted. What's there? We know Invercargill exists. And if you would not be so cheap, you just get on a flight and go down there and see for yourself. So, you put that same attitude to Bhagavad Gita, give him a fair go. Don't dogmatically refuse to step into the Krishna laboratory. In the privacy of your own home, some Bhagavad Gita cover to cover. Start off with an open mind. Well, Krishna the Supreme is going to come. Anyway. Everybody's getting old. matter what religion you are or aren't, if you're Jewish or Christian or Krishna follower or atheist, you call yourself, or agnostic, getting old. What's new about it? Why is that happening? An intelligent person looks at the problem. It's what's just nature that's different. Nature's making us, it's part of nature. No need to be so inquisitive or reflective, it's just nature. What is nature? And whose nature is it? So now we get to the text from what we did with focus on today. This is from the 13th chapter of what we do, which is entitled Nature, the Enjoyer and Consciousness. Nature, the Enjoyer and Consciousness. So Krishna is speaking to Arjuna. I shall now explain the knowable, knowing which you will taste the eternal. Brahman, the spirit, beginningless and subordinate to me, lies beyond the cause and effect in this material world. How do you taste the eternal? Brahman, that's the stanza we're meaning, the all-pervasive spiritual energy, has no beginning. Now, interesting point you see there. Krishna says it's subordinate to me. In other words, it is not that the energy is beyond anything else. No. The energy is subordinate to the source. Let's turn to that. Chapter 13. Close to that. That's the page. Thank you. tasting like a wine tasted changed and masticated. Exasperated is one expression. You know, chilling down has already been used. That expression is used for 5 minutes or less. You try it with that. Dinner. Chew it. How many times do you need to chew your food?
For the specific purpose of extirpating the living entity from entrapment, illusory energy, and taking you to the spirit plane. Said another way, the body we need is meant to rescue the spirit soul from this material covering. Situate you back to your original spiritual position. So it does have a purpose. And it's funny, there's so many commentaries on what it means in the English language, but 99.9% of them miss the point. And that was like, what is the function of Bhagavad-gita? You know how it is in the field of literature. He always said, we don't mind people putting forth their own views on Bhagavad Gita, but they shouldn't call it Bhagavad Gita. They should call it their own book. Fair enough. Just like if someone decided, well, I'm going to write a description of Rodney. And they wrote that. He's from Peru. He's very skinny. He loves hang gliding. And he hangs out all the time in Antarctica. That's right. You would say, you're entitled to your imagination, but don't say it's me. But similarly, as far as Bhagavad Gita, there are many commentaries. And they get very fanciful. So, Swami Prabhupada said, we don't mind that people interpret to their wildest delight, but don't call it Bhagavad Gita, call it your own book. Fair enough. Otherwise, if you take Bhagavad Gita straight on, then the message is inescapable. That we are parts, spiritual parts of a spiritual whole. And our job is to reawaken that consciousness. Does anybody have any questions about this point? Yes. Your first time here? Spiritual ramifications of quantum physics. You know, that's a very trendy field. Anyway, I'm sure you two will have my next conversation. So, meanwhile, I'm back to Bhagavad Gita. We really, in order to come to grips with Bhagavad Gita, we've got to kind of come to grips with what we want to do with our life. And in order to come to grips with what we want to do with our life, we've got to first understand what life is. So Bhagavad Gita, from the very beginning, is kind of putting you up against the wall, pointing the finger. In the midst of a battlefield, in between two opposing armies, the essential question of what is life is raised. And you can't find a more dramatic situation or having instruction or making questions and getting answers. You can't think of a more dramatic situation for such these deepest issues to be contemplated in between two opposing armies on a battlefield, right before the battle's about to start. All of a sudden, you have this dialogue, 18 chapters of dialogue, beginning with the point of what is life. Now, obviously, a soldier will be very concerned with that, in that he's, by his occupation, he's supposed to take life, whatever that is. And that's the whole point of why we need them. The soldier, Arjuna, if you look at the cover, it's Arjuna in the back. He's wondering, why do I have to fight? Even though he knows it's a proper cause. You see, according to the Vedas, there's no strict injunction for nonviolence. There's no strict command that you have to be nonviolent. He shudders. Why did Mahatma Gandhi read Bhagavad Gita? You read on the back here, Mahatma Gandhi says, when doubts haunt me, when disappointments stare me in the face, and I see not one ray of hope on the horizon, I turn to Bhagavad Gita and find a verse to comfort me. And I immediately begin to smile in the midst of overwhelming sorrow. Those who meditate on the Gita will derive fresh joy and new meaning from it every day. So, we all know that Gandhi was called a pacifist, and he was for nonviolence. You'd be surprised that, although many Westerners believe it was Gandhi who caused the British to leave India, many people in India feel that it was actually the threat of armed insurrection by Subhash Chandra Bose. In any case, Gandhi, he was advocating, and he liked Bhagavad Gita, but Bhagavad Gita is an action for him. You won't find nonviolence mentioned in Bhagavad Gita. Now that obviously may cause you to shudder. Is it nonviolent spirituality? Well, let's just take surgery. When the surgeon's operating on you, that's actually violence. It's cutting you, but it's for the purpose of helping you. And you say, here it comes. Now this sounds like some kind of Middle East holy war talk, in which the disease segments of society have to be cut out. No, not like that at all. According to the ancient Vedic texts of India, there can be a violent response if someone tries to burn your house, assault your wife, plunder your property, not just in the living area, but plunder your property, administer you poison, assault your children, like that. Now you understand. None of you can stand by and allow someone to assault your husband, or assault you, kill your husband or wife. None of you would stand around and allow someone to burn your house down, everybody inside, or administer poison to your family. Do something about it. So, this battle in Bhagavad Gita is taking place because of those kind of reasons. Therefore, Arjuna, as a member of the warrior class, had no reason to shirk from fighting. Now, what do we mean by the warrior class? Those of you who are university students may know something about Plato. Yes, you would. You're a physics student. Okay. So, Plato, he had this concept. What would he call the philosopher kings? That is because if you understand the whole picture, you'll find out that much Greek philosophy comes from Vedic philosophy. Plato called it philosopher king. In Sanskrit, you'll find in this book the term Rajarshi. Raja means a ruler, and Rishi means sage. And, you know, Plato had this concept of citizens of three natures with gold, silver, and bronze. That corresponds to the much more ancient Bhagavad Gita. The three modes of nature, goodness, past, and ignorance. Anyway, those who understand Vedic culture, the ancient Vedic culture of India, know that Greek culture is expat Vedic culture. So Arjuna was a warrior by profession. That means that was his occupation, and he willingly embraced that occupation. You see, according to Vedic culture in ancient India, it's not that anybody joined the army, quote unquote. It's not that anybody fought battles. That's like it is today. In Vedic culture, anybody who was in the military had that nature. That was their voluntary occupation, and they had those kind of abilities. Not that everybody you meet on these days, you know, is a martial person. You can still see, even in today's mixed up kind of world, you can see people with martial tendencies, fierce athletes, like rugby, like iron. Certainly anybody who plays rugby, no pads on that, you can be a iron there, especially they have a warrior nature. They have them in New Zealand. I don't think you've ever met them. Military men who really like the military. I think that's where it's at. Have you ever met people like that? Have you? They really think the world needs a military. Someone's got to protect. Someone's got to take a stand for democracy and for freedom. And So, in any case, Arjuna was of the martial type. And he wasn't drafted into fighting. This is the modern system that would have to be for battle and all kinds of men put into the army. Just like the old people in New Zealand talking about what the history of World War II. Place was practically empty of all kinds of men. She graduated from high school, dating one man. The war started, and all the men who spent high school, they were gone. She didn't see her husband to be a few years later. Did good. You were chased and waited for him for 8 years, not knowing whether he'd come back and get her alive. He said, "Well, listen, that kind of thing is just there's nobody else around."
All the men were gone.
That's the way it was. All the young men were gone, and the young girls would just every day check the newspaper in the morning, see which were their friends who were casualties. Everybody, of course, lived in fear of the telegrams coming, whatever the normal notices came. How did they come here? The states that came by telegram. People in the states would live in fear of a Western Union car driving up and telegrams being brought to the door. So how do they do it here? Anything. Everybody lived in fear of being notified. So, that is not the Vedic system. The Vedic system is that only the martial class fights. And not that the civilians are involved. You see, when you read Bhagavad Gita about the battle of Kurukshetra, you've got to understand. Because don't think it's like the way people fight wars today. No, it only involved the martial class, voluntary fighters who like to fight, in fact, would feel bad if it wasn't a fight. Just like, you know, athletes, there's no World Cup. They feel bad. They want a chance to compete. So, only the martial class, and they would not fight in the cities and get the civilians involved, as is the style these days. No. The battle of Kurukshetra took place in a barren, useless land.
That's a very important point to understand. Not in the cities, not gutting the farmland. Now, how is war happening today? Does anybody know the statistics of civilian deaths? I can tell you. World War I, 10% of the casualties were civilians. And as you all know, World War I was supposed to be the war to end all. Everybody had learned their lesson after World War I. Then, some years later, of course, there was World War II. 50% of the casualties were civilians. Now, this is the advanced 20th century now, where people are learning to have peace and not to kill each other anymore, to settle their disputes through negotiation and the United Nations. You look at the statistics and you see otherwise, regardless of what newspapers or CNN. World War I, 10% of casualties civilians. World War II, 50%. Certainly, humanity learned its lesson after World War II. Vietnam War, 90% of the casualties civilians. And now you have Bosnia and Chechnya, and they're almost all civilians were killed. And in fact, in Bosnia and Chechnya, especially Bosnia, they mainly go for the civilians, not even the men, they go for the women and children, thinking that if we terrorize the women and children so badly, the men will give up. So if we want to make a quick end to this war, we kill the women and children, assault the women. That is the purpose of policy. So we think that the 20th century is closing in a very advanced way, but actually things are going down there. Any statistical analysis will show that too. Of course, you may say, but if we study the lifespans, how many years people live, we can see that by the time this century comes to an end, the lifespans in the modernized, developed Western countries are longer. Are you sure? Why not consider it this way? When you're calculating lifespans, average lifespan for the New Zealand population or the American population, then, you know how they do that. They just take the ages of everybody who died and get an average. Now, why don't you, different way of looking at things now, like you said, take into account when you calculate that average, take into account all the numbers of abortions, children who are killed in the womb, and factor that in, then the lifespan figure comes down quite a bit. Just pulling that as something you're thinking about, you're going to get a sense. The whole problem, of course, not understanding the abortion issue is that nobody understands what life is. So we're going to be dealing with that today. What is life? Alright. So the point is, I'm explaining all this to you so you can understand that there's nothing tribalistic or primitive about the Basel Group shape on which what we need is founded on. That's the medium of which we get. Alright. So there they are in a deserted piece of land. Two professional martial forces are about to do each other in. And it was a proper battle in that one side was being totally terrorized and exploited by the other. I mean, their wives were being terrorized, their property was being totally confiscated. Totally. Not just somebody coming to your door and stealing your, stereo or something. Totally wiping you out, assaulting your wife, totally wiping out your property, trying to poison your whole family, these things are going on. So in other words, it wasn't just a kind of silly fight. Just like, I know it's very advanced now, human society, European countries, very advanced, European-derived countries, very advanced. But as you well know, 2 weeks ago, Turkey and Greece were about to slug it out over two small islands, tiny islands. Not even islands, islets, or anything called small islands. People call small islands. No, small islands, huh? Small islands. Of rock outcropping and inhabited by huge, very tiny amount of mountain goats. Just 2 weeks ago. 13 degrees super, about to get to the brink. No human beings, just two rock-filled small islands, like something along the Bay of Islands, and that was in England's state, Cavalty or something, north of the Bay of Islands. No. Yeah, right. Now they got some, some are moderate, but some are just lumps of earth and rocks sticking up. So it was like that. But they had the mountain goats on it. And at the same time, you had Japan and Korea exchanging hot words over two similar islands in between them. Things have advanced. We'd like to take that. Oh, we're not primitive like in the times of Genghis Khan and the Roman Empire, the Dark Ages. We are very rational. We know how to talk things over and spare lives. Forget it. For example, the Gulf War. Generally what the people are being told is that because Iraq invaded Kuwait, therefore it had to be retaliation. Now, what they don't tell you publicly, but it is common knowledge in the USA among intelligent people, that Iraq signaled to the U.S. ambassador about a month before they invaded that we feel that that territory on the border belongs to Iraq, and we're going to do something about it. And the U.S. ambassador, the U.S. government, kind of gave them a signal like, that's none of our business, that's your thing. Now you may wonder why they do that. You can answer that question. Why do they want them to do that? Okay, time being, you got to practice keep your armed forces in shape, you know? So, just saying all these things so you understand the nature of the times you live in, and you don't get squeamish when you read about a battle. These battles were conducted in a way that's 100 times more civilized than anything we've ever seen. No women and children slaughtered. No women raped. That's what they're paying for. That's how the generals keep the soldiers fired up. You capture that colony and rape all the women. Was the fight justified? One side had to defend themselves because all these atrocities were being performed. And besides the just cause for fighting, in the midst of this conversation, so Arjuna. He's saying, Krishna, even though we are perfectly right in fighting, the other side is terrorizing us, even breaking the codes of proper military behavior. Still, what's the point of all this fighting? I like everybody on the other side. They're my friends. Some of them are my military teachers. Some of them are even related to me. Big kinships. Some of them are my distant relatives. Some of them even took care of me when I was a young kid. What's the point in fighting? I don't see how any good could come out of this. If we win, how is that good? Because we'll be sorry that my friends on the other side have been killed. And if we lose, we'll be sorry too. So either way, it's too much for me. So Arjuna, in the midst of these two armies, lay down his bow. But then Krishna began to explain it. Arjuna, you're a military man. You have a just cause to defend yourself, defend your family, defend the population from an unrighteous attack. From any point of view, it's unrighteous. Now, how can you not fight? Where is the good quality in that to abandon resistance to an aggressor? secondly, what are the lives of the people that are going to be that die on the battlefield? What is life anyway? Before even the lament, in other words, first figure out what life is. And then we can decide whether to lament or not. You know, that is a very compelling point. How the temperature gets too warm or too cool. Okay? So, before you lament, for the life is going to extend, figure out what life is. Before you lament for the blood that will be spilled, figure out, is the living entity blood or not? Don't you think that's intelligent? What do you say at this point?
Thank you.
they know they can predict how things will work according to quantum physics, but why it happens, they don't know. And what kind of reality they're dealing with, no idea.
If you want to really be a real physicist, you'll go crazy.
But how do they avoid that? They don't think about these essential issues. Someday you'll find it without looking for it. It'll appear, so don't worry now. Don't worry about it. You know, you've got to get a job. You've got to get a research grant. You've got to get a teaching position. You have to support your family. In this way, things are all in an understanding way. Bhagavad Gita is not like Bhagavad Gita says, stop. Let's discuss what we're doing. Let's understand. On the deepest level, what we're dealing with.